Good evening and welcome to City Visions, now celebrating its 20th year on local public radio, KALW. I'm your host, Joseph Pache. Our topic for the hour tonight is Far From Rome, on being gay and Catholic in the Bay Area. We have all had an occasion to question a long-held affiliation, be it political, familial, social, or religious. But for those who identify as gay and Catholic, questions about affiliation can border on the existential. Official church policy on gay issues is intolerant, to say the least. The Vatican considers homosexual acts sinful and gay people disordered, and same-sex marriage as out of the question. So why would a gay or lesbian person choose to associate with the Catholic Church? In this hour, we explore the various ways in which the LGBT Catholics in the Bay Area address this tension between Rome's teachings and their personal values and identity. How do Catholic parishes in our progressive region embrace diversity while towing the Vatican line? And what is the role of the independent Catholic movement here? And can local churches and individuals succeed in influencing official Vatican policy? Joining me tonight in the studio to address these questions and more are Donal Godfrey. He's Associate Director of the University Ministry at the University of San Francisco. He's also a Jesuit priest and the author of Gays and Grays, the story of the gay community at the Most Holy Redeemer Catholic Church. Welcome.
Thank you, Joseph.
And we're also joined by Christine Fahrenbach. She's an ordained deacon and member of the Roman Catholic Women Priests Movement. Welcome, Christine.
Thanks.
And finally, we're joined by Vincent Pizzuto. He is Associate Professor in the Department of Theology and Religious Studies at the University of San Francisco. Welcome, Vincent.
Pleasure to be here.
And as always, we invite you, our listeners, to join our conversation, and we'll open our phones in about 20 minutes. You can dial 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. You can email us now at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com, or you can join us on our Facebook page, which is City Visions. So I'm going to start with you, Vincent. How would you describe the relationship of the Catholic Church as a whole to homosexuality?
Well, I think you can find the question really is around what do you mean by church? So if you're looking at something like the hierarchy or the official teachings, then I think the lead-in that you gave describes it somewhat accurately. It's not so much that the homosexual person is disordered, but the desire towards same-sex attraction would be regarded as disordered. But the church is a much more complex institution than simply what the magisterium would teach on it, which is that there can be at no time any kind of moral or ethical acceptance of same-gender relationships. But more broadly, you find somewhere around 77 Catholics, for example, 77% of all Catholics in the United States would be open to the idea of same-gender unions or same-gender marriage of some sort. So when you begin to incorporate the church in all its complexities and its membership, it's a place where there's a lot of debate going on, and we're really living in a time when there's a tremendous amount of fervor around this issue.
Mm. And how long would you say has there been this, I don't know, this spread of opinion, so to speak, on homosexuality or homosexual acts, as you mention it, between the hierarchy of the church and the congregants and perhaps others in the church?
Well, I think as long as the church has existed. We've really seen only in the 70s into the 80s where the church has begun to really make official pronouncements that we're more aware of today from both on the level of the Vatican, but also the level of the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops in response to some of the turbulence. So we're really seeing a much more defined approach from the magisterium in terms of how it's dealing with this issue, but it's as old as the church itself.
And you mentioned magisterium a couple of times. What exactly does that mean?
So the magisterium would be regarded as just the official teaching of the church. So the Pope, its bishops, cardinals, etc., that are making a formal decisions which are more or less binding on the faithful.
Okay. And Donal, Godfrey, do you agree with the way Vincent has characterized this?
Pretty much. I think there's the teaching level, and then there's the pastoral practice and the experience of people in the parishes. And Catholic Church is a community of many different communities. And so if you just read the media, you probably, and you're gay, you probably have quite a negative understanding of the Catholic Church. But if you're in a parishioner at Most Holy Redeemer or at a Catholic institution like the University of San Francisco, you may have a very different experience.
Mm-hmm. And why is it that we're not hearing about this more?
Well, for one thing, the more dramatic gets attention in the media. That's understandable when the Vatican comes out with a document like the letter on pastoral care of a homosexual person in 1986. That gets a lot of attention in the media. But when the University of San Francisco introduced benefits for domestic partners, that is a very different. That doesn't get as much attention.
So the University of San Francisco has domestic partner benefits.
Yes, it does.
And
yes.
For how long?
How many years now?
I think since 2003 or 2004.
And the interesting thing was we didn't do it. We didn't try and get around Catholic teaching. We actually tried to use Catholic teaching to introduce benefits. We brought moral theologians onto campus. They talked to the Board of Trustees. They had to go through a whole process. It wasn't to try and get around teaching. We actually integrated some of the teaching in bringing in benefits. And the other good news is that other Catholic universities have copied us now and are doing the same thing around the country.
And what response have universities like yours and others gotten from Rome?
I don't know that Rome got involved in it. I'm not sure.
It didn't. What was done to sort of avoid a greater conflict was there was an introduction of a rule that permitted domestic benefits to domestic partnerships regardless of the relationship that it was to the faculty or staff member. So it could be a mother who's living with a particular faculty member and is under their care who we would be able to extend those benefits to as well, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. And so so you're saying, Donald, that, that it's that we don't hear about it because it's not as sensational. Yeah. What are some other details about perhaps the less than monolithic way that Catholics interact with homosexuality as an issue that we don't hear about?
Well, I think what's happening, I mean, I wrote the book Gays and Grace about a particular parish, mostly Redeemer, which is in the Castro, in the gay neighborhood of San Francisco, and how that changed and became inclusive of the LGBTQ community. But I think what's happened at Most Holy Redeemer is beginning to happen in other parishes, not everywhere, not universally, but what's happening. I was recently talking to somebody who's on a parish council of a, I would have thought, a rather traditional parish in San Francisco, and this woman was telling me, oh, on our pastoral council we have two gay male couples and the pastor, and they're just treated like any family, like any other family in that parish, and that's not Most Holy Redeemer. So that, and the pastor included, but that would depend very much on the particular parish. Mm. So it varies a lot from place to place.
Yes, Vincent.
I think also, you know, we live in a world of sound bites where most of the information we're getting has to be, conveyed within a matter of minutes or seconds. And there's very little tolerance or room for the kind of diversity and ideas of and opinions and complexities around institutions that have been around as long as the Catholic Church. So for people who are getting their information strictly from the media, there tends to be a bias against such institutions. We tend, as Donald was saying, to really focus on the big sort of ideas, the big agendas, the hot-button issues. But for those people who are within the church where you're actually living the experience, what you experience as the local church within the Catholic Church at large is very often much different than what you would expect to see from looking in from the outside.
Mm. And I want to bring in Christine Fehrenbach at this point. So Christine, hearing what you've heard so far, what do you have to add about the nuances to this discussion around the fact that there's a lot more to Catholicism and homosexuality or the relationship between Catholics and homosexuality than perhaps we get to hear in the media?
Well, I'd certainly agree with what Vincent just said, that the church it is different wherever you are, and so that in any given local community, it might feel different from one place to another. So, for example, you might be in a more conservative area of the country and run into much more, say, homophobia and lack of inclusion. And I know in certain places, there has historically been such a fear of homosexuality, to have a homosexual child and to even, for some people, to even be able to tell their priest that they have a child who's gay. And it has been very stigmatizing even for the family. And that's true in some places and, of course, pretty much not true here, I would say, in most places. And so I think that element is very important that they both bring in. Maybe it may not be the time to bring this up, but it is also true that I think that being gay or lesbian in the Catholic Church is different for women than it is for men, because it is a different experience to be female in the eyes of the church to be male. It's just there's a quite a bit of imbalance there. in terms of the things that women are not traditionally allowed to do, and that even is in fact mandated against, like women cannot be ordained priests and deacons, for example. So I think that element also comes in.
So you're saying that the experience is also for gay and lesbian parishioners is not the same, depending on not only where you are in the country, but whether what your gender is.
Exactly.
Because there may be some more openness to gay men, for example, than lesbians. Are you suggesting that?
Not necessarily that. I think that, and this is anecdotal, I haven't done a study, but I think more lesbian women have probably given up on the church because of the lack of inclusiveness for women.
So it's the women's issues that sort of...
It's the women's issues, right.
That come first.
Yes.
I see. Donald, you say,
that's my experience as well. I think for women who are lesbian and Catholic, it is a double whammy. In a parish like most Holy Redeemer, there are smaller numbers of lesbians who are part of the community there than gay men, and I think it's quite... I can understand that. And I think... But I basically agree with you there.
And I want to go back to something that we were talking about a few minutes ago that made me think of... other social issues that the Roman Catholic Magisterium, as you use the term, Vincent, has taken some pretty conservative stances on. So abortion, divorce, probably some other things here that I'm forgetting. But how is the spectrum of opinion within the Catholic Church and the practice, perhaps, with and the environment from parish to parish replicated when it comes to homosexuality issues? Is that just a yet another social conservative issue, or is there something different about homosexuality when it comes to its interplay with the Catholic Church? Do you get what I'm going there?
So you're asking, is there another dimension to the issue of homosexuality?
Right.
And I think the dimension is that you can point to what I would think of as a systemic homophobia rampant throughout the church, or at the very least a kind of heterosexism throughout the church. So that, for example, why is it that priests who are supposedly living celibate lives are discouraged, dissuaded, or frankly not permitted to speak openly about their homosexual orientation if they're supposed to be living a celibate life? I mean, one of the teachings within the Roman Church is that being gay is not in itself sinful. It's acting upon those desires that become sinful. So you would expect that it would actually be in the church's interest to have supposedly celibate men providing a role model for their parishioners by saying, hey, you know, I'm gay and I'm celibate and this is maybe possible for you too. But you don't see that. You see the opposite of that. You see a sort of repression or denial of the church wanting priests to admit that by and large, certainly at least publicly. So that says something about the church's discomfort with homosexuality. And I think it's even broader than that. There's a kind of erotophobia. I mean, I think the church is uncomfortable with sexuality, period.
And Christine, you're nodding your head there.
Yeah, I think I would definitely agree with that. I think one of the things that really is missing, that there's this kind of unequal view of, say, or I guess perhaps all priests are presumed to be heterosexual, and they are celibate. And if you did come out as a priest, your commitment to celibacy would be automatically doubted and challenged. And so, you know, having been around a number of priests who I know to be gay and people that I had gone to school with, it's a little beyond don't ask, don't tell. It's, you know, it's pretty much don't tell.
I think that's true. I think people, I don't think there's any strict rule about it, but social pressure is very strong not to talk about this topic.
Right.
As a priest.
But you're, and just to...
Having said that, in San Francisco, it's rather unique. Sometimes I think some people say, sometimes it's harder to come out as Catholic in San Francisco than it is to come out as gay, to come out as a Catholic priest can really spoil the evening in some situations.
Yeah.
And just to close the loop on this point, so the issues around homosexuality are different, you think, than other social issues like abortion, like divorce? Is it really, like... It has its own separate. I wanted to hear some other points of view on that from Donald and.
Well, I think I think there are separate issues involved in each of those things. They overlap in some respects, but I do think two things that perhaps would help to understand Catholics who are gay and people not who dissent on any of these issues mm-hmm. from the church's official position. One is the role of conscience in the Catholic teaching, that we do believe that people have to follow their own conscience. We say it has to be informed, so we would argue that it has to take seriously the tradition of the church, but if you ultimately come in conscience to a different decision, then you have to follow your own conscience over the church's teaching. That's certainly the case for many parishioners at Most Holy Redeemer. They would be in a similar situation to Catholics who practice artificial birth control, which is against the church's teaching. You don't hear any sermons really these days much about that. So I think Catholics who dissent or disagree on to the church's teaching on this issue in a parish like Most Holy Redeemer would be in a similar situation to women who practice birth control, at least on that issue.
Yes, Christine.
I think that the issues you're talking about, specifically abortion, divorce, homosexuality, contraception, these are, are pretty, they're hot button issues in terms of Catholic teaching. And if you look at each of these issues, say, for example, contraception and divorce, to use contraception as something that is, as Donnell said, just not talked about in the pulpit and is not really a pastoral issue for most people, as is divorce. It is much more comfortable being a divorced person in the church. And, formerly, if you were divorced, you couldn't receive communion. And I don't know anybody who's divorced who goes to Catholic Church that does not take communion. And so there's a certain kind of social transformation of these issues, I think, outside of the church as well. And transformation is kind of the optimal thing, that people in turn become not just used to an issue, but begin to see the full picture and can apply their own thinking to it. And I think socially, our nation has come a long way in terms of lesbian gay issues.
So, Vincent, from what I'm hearing from Donald and Christine, is that it sounds like it's just a matter of time, that maybe as societal views around certain issues change, so does the church eventually kind of move along. Would you say that's true, or is there something different here?
I think the difference that you're pointing to, or trying to point to, or that I feel beneath it, is what's at stake here is a certain kind of fear. I mean, when we talk about homophobia, that's precisely what that means. Fear. People are afraid of gay people. The church is afraid of gay people. And fear does terrible things to a society, terrible things to a church. People aren't afraid of divorced people. The church isn't afraid of women who've had abortion. But there's something about sexuality that it would seem we fear. Perhaps we all fear it on some level. Fear its power. Fear that it could overcome us. Fear that it could be out of control. And I think that fear that remains addressed within church teaching, but yet I think can be demonstrated palpably throughout its organization, is what's at stake. I mean, in some ways, the fundamental question comes down to, why is the church so obsessed with preventing gay Catholics from marrying the person they're eventually going to stop having sex with? Right. That's what happens. We get married, and sex within the first year or so of a relationship is not what it is 10 years, 20 years, 30 years down the road. We don't have a theology of sexuality. We can't even talk to heterosexual married couples about what's expected or normal 30, 40 years into a marriage. So there's really no development around how sexuality plays a role between any two human beings, heterosexual or homosexual. The political ethos within the Bay Area more looks at this issue as something that we would regard, for example, as a human rights issue. But the church keeps seeing this as a sexual ethics issue. And until we get until we sort of have some conversation around which is it, or is it both, or how are these two types of issues interrelated, we just keep clashing, because the very premise of what we're arguing is sort of in contradistinction.
I think that's right, because I think the tradition has a lot to say on these issues that could be valuable and helpful, but at the moment there's a sort of impasse between many Catholics and the teaching, and that impasse, I don't see there's going to be much change in the near future in the church's official position on this. The teaching does evolve and change over time, we know that, but I don't see it happening anytime soon, but I think it needs to take place. Theologians need to discuss it. Ethicists need to talk about it. People, we need to see role models of holy people who are Catholic and lesbian and gay and bisexual, and we need to have the conversation. What does it mean to be a lesbian who's a holy person? People don't put those things together.
I just want to reintroduce the program in case you're just joining us. This is City Visions on Local Public Radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and on the web at kalw.org. I'm Joseph Pache, and tonight we're discussing being gay and Catholic in the Bay Area with our guests, Donald Godfrey, Associate Director of University Ministry at the University of San Francisco, a Jesuit priest and author of Gays and Grays, the Story of the Gay Community at the Most Holy Redeemer Catholic Church here in San Francisco. Also, Christine Farnbach, ordained deacon and member of the Roman Catholic Women's Priest Movement, which I'd like to hear a lot more about in just a few minutes. And then Vincent Pasuto, associate professor in the Department of Theology and Religious Studies at the University of San Francisco. We open our phone lines to you, our listeners, to join our conversation. 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. Or you can email us at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com or follow us and post something on our Facebook page, which is City Visions. 415-841-4134 or email us at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com. Yes, Vincent.
Yeah, I just was wanting to follow up on what Donald said. I mean, one of the things we have to understand is this battle within the church is very much underway. It's a long time before we'll see the kinds of changes that many people in the Bay Area would hope for. But this is not something that's going to be fought on political grounds. I mean, no march on the Vatican is going to create the change we need. What we need is to convince the church theologically, biblically, et cetera, that the current interpretations are either inadequate or don't suffice, that the Bible, as we understand it, really doesn't address the current issue as we now have come to understand homosexuality or human sexuality in general. And what needs to change is not so much the scriptures, which of course we cannot change, but the interpretations that have been given to them. And that's going to take a lot of theological and biblically interpretive work to move us forward.
But there is that, and I want to say I did agree there is a difference between that you can look at something in the broader culture in terms of a certain kind of ethic versus a moral issue. And so in the church, you don't get political transactions where you can change laws so that it makes it visible to other people. But I do think that the culture itself isn't that far, much further ahead of the church in terms of if you look at the internal processes of people and how really integrating an inclusion of people who are homosexual is fully integrated and kind of held in a healthy fashion. Mm-hmm. But the law does help in that. And so in the church, it relies entirely on education, as Vincent was talking about, and internal transformation as a result of those discussions. And part of the problem in the church is that in many situations, there's a lot of things that you really aren't allowed to talk about. And to develop these conversations, as you both know, on the parish level often takes a lot of time to kind of cut through that kind of fear that Vincent was talking about.
Mm-hmm. And then what does this say about it, if it's going to take sort of the academic argument, perhaps, to create change? What is the do we have a template, or do we have some sort of examples of other transformations that have had based on sort of a reinterpretation of the scripture? To sort of point to and say, oh, this is how it happens.
Sure. I mean, the whole mm-hmm. Galileo affair, where we transitioned from the Copernican notion of a geocentric universe where the Earth was seen as the center to Galileo's discovery that, in fact, the Earth was the center of our solar system, just simply didn't jive with the accounts of Genesis as they had then been being interpreted. Centuries later, of course, the church has clearly moved in a different direction, much to its embarrassment for having taken so long. But clearly nobody in the Roman church today would try to continue to argue for a geocentric or Earth-centered universe, even though at the time Galileo's proposition seemed to be heresy and seemed to be directly contrary to everything the church had thought about the Genesis stories of creation, etc. So we've seen these many times.
So there's precedent for this.
Absolutely.
So let's bring it to the personal experience mm-hmm. of what it means to be Catholic or identify as Catholic, and then have to grapple with this issue of a church that is not hospitable to one's identity. Let's start with you, Christine. How have you dealt with that tension?
Well, of course, that is a lengthy topic, but I think one of the things I have done is I think as a child, I was very touched by my faith and also the kind of mystical aspects of it. And I think many children are really have a spiritual openness that kind of shuts down over time. And mine did stick with me. And in terms of the church, I think I was very drawn and very protected and cared for by the church. And that was until I started getting an education. And I studied theology in college. I went on to do a Master of Divinity. And having that education, which for me was really helping, really trying to reconcile what is it to be spiritual and to be human? And is a love of God part of one's human experience? Or is it part of being in a structure that has particular rules? And that journey has taken me to a number of different places, not all of which, not that I wouldn't mention them, it's just too long to mention them. And then, you know, I find that, you know, a love of God and a faithfulness just sticks with you wherever you try to find an answer. This kind of theme keeps coming up. And I would say that my upbringing as an education as a Roman Catholic is really part of the deepest, it's, you know, embedded in the deepest part of myself. And so then you try to align with an institution that does not validate that. And I'm not sure if I can answer. I don't think that I have reconciled all of it, to be honest. But I know that there are a lot of ways to be fed. There's a lot of ways to be church. There are a lot of ways to be community. And there's, I think as you get older, you develop a certain type of patience. But where things, you know, shift for me, and I think for a lot of women, is that the Roman Catholic Church is not inclusive of women, of women's ministries, of women's participation. I think there's a misogynist shadow to the Roman Catholic Church that has a big impact on the homosexual issue, which might be more complex than we want to get into about that. And so it's an ongoing process, and I know that I remain in my faith. I love my faith. I think a profound journey, as I think most of us are, in terms of what is really true. And I am not entirely aligned with the magisterium. Mm-hmm.
And tell us about what steps you took.
Well, as I said, I got a lot of education because it was really drawing me forward. And I found alternative ways to be in community. I know a big, I had a period of estrangement from the church where I was trying other different things, you know, my Zen period and, you know, different things like that, and have been greatly enriched by a number of practices. And I returned to Roman Catholicism when I moved to Santa Cruz and participated in the gay and lesbian ministry at Holy Cross Church in Santa Cruz. It was a very active, large ministry, I think, largely because of a charismatic person, but also there was some support, a lot of support from the pastor and some support from the bishop down there. My experience in this group was, the playing field really is level in terms of our relationship with God, in terms of the celebration of the Eucharist, that nothing can really come between oneself and the love of God. And that was very compelling for a while, and then I found that the church began to clamp down a lot on gay issues. I became much more aware of how assaultive it began to feel to me to be a woman in the church and not being validated, not being as if someone could tell me what the Spirit was telling me.
Mm-hmm. And then you moved on to this organization, the Women's Priests Movement. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, again, another long topic, and I'll be succinct. Roman Catholic Women Priests is an initiative in the Roman Catholic Church, not sponsored by the church. In fact, any woman who attempts to be ordained or is ordained is immediately excommunicated just by the fact of thinking they have become ordained. And you're also, the church has decided recently that if you are a woman being ordained, you're also, I'm sure you guys will find this humorous or know this term, you're guilty of what they call a delicta graviora. And so if it's in Latin, it's got to be bad. And the delicta graviora is the most grievous sin. And the only other group of people guilty of the delicta graviora in the Roman Catholic Church are priests who have molested children. So there's a lot to talk about that. I have other ideas on that. But anyway, RCWP, Roman Catholic Women Church, priest, is a movement that started in Europe, and when seven women were ordained on the Danube River, ordained by a German bishop in good standing, who remains a German bishop in good standing and very active in the church. His identity is kept secret for obvious reasons. And that movement spread throughout Europe, also kind of low-key in Europe now, to the United States, Canada, Australia. There are some Roman Catholic women priests in Central America. And the point of the initiative is to ordain women and also to develop a model of clergy that is non-clerical, that is, and to be a group that is inclusive, that really at the table you are welcome. There's no buts, you know, yeah, but you are not. It's a movement that is evolving, and I would say the movement has maybe 100 people involved in it. I can't say little influence because it always engenders a lot of discussion. I mean, if the Vatican is going to say you're guilty of a delicta graviori, obviously it's gotten their attention. And mostly women have small house churches. A few people have developed larger parishes, larger churches that are very active in justice and ministry and they're, you know, being Catholic in their walk of life. The movement does not, we do not see ourselves as separate from the church. We are not in rebellion with the church. We see ourselves as being inclusive in the church. And, you know, if there's a topic that you can't talk about it, you have to start the conversation yourself. Hmm. And so RCWP does that.
415-841-4134 or feedback at cityvisionsradio.com to join our conversation tonight about being gay or lesbian and Catholic in the Bay Area here on KLW San Francisco. 415-841-4134 or feedback at cityvisionsradio.com. That was Christine Fahrenbach, who is a ordained deacon and member of the Roman Catholic Women's Priest Movement, and she's also a psychologist practicing in Santa Cruz. And Vincent Pasuto, I understand that you have also found an alternative to the the traditional path, so to speak.
Right.
Tell us about that.
So the independent Catholic movement of which I'm a part is largely under the radar, I think, of most people. It's actually comprised of a series of different churches that span the theological gamut from very traditionalist or conservative to very progressive. The particular community that I was ordained in is the Celtic Christian Church, and we take our cue in terms of our church polity, our governance, our organization, the way that we understand ourselves in light of Catholic tradition. We take our cue from the ancient Celtic church, which in its own time, the Roman Empire never made it as far as Ireland, but the missionaries would continue to cross very porous borders. And starting with people around the time of St. Patrick, began to evangelize the pagan Celts there. But never would the ancient Celts themselves have understood themselves as a separate church apart from the church that was on the continent, the so-called Roman Church. Through a series of synods in the 7th and 8th century, there was more of a merger of differences between the two separate communities in terms of the distinctiveness. And unfortunately, the Celtic Church really lost a lot of what was distinctive and beautiful about it. And the community that I belong to really seeks to recover that in somewhat of a modern way, to try to live by the spirituality and the way of prayer, et cetera, of that Celtic tradition. My own community in the Bay Area, which is named after an ancient Celtic monastic outpost, which I call New Skellig, is really also a house church where we gather once a month to really support each other in the question of what it means to live a contemplative life in the world as a Christian. We celebrate liturgy, we sit together in meditation, we have a shared meal, and then we sort of spend the afternoon reflecting on our faith lives with one another. We meet only once a month very intentionally because I really wanted our community of New Skellig to not be a community of division, but really one that contributes back to the larger church. So we don't, for example, take collections. I ask my parishioners to give an extra collection when they return to their more anchor parishes on the other weeks. We try to function in ways that help the members of New Skellig be what I call contemplative leaven for the larger church. So take what we do here, take the intimacy, take what we've been able to offer one another, and bring that to your ministry in your larger parish. So we have an open Eucharistic table because we see the unity in the churches as far more foundational than any so-called divisions that we may argue about. And we really try to embody that both within the Celtic Christian Church and in my own local community within that church as well.
And do you attend services at a or mass at a another Catholic church besides this one?
I do. So when I'm not gathering my own community, I will either go to the local Catholic church or a local Anglican church, or move around within. So we kind of understand Catholicity as much broader than what any one institution can really hold or possess. And so look to all of the churches, particularly those that share the same sort of sacramental, creedal, historical tradition, as moments or occasions of the Catholic Church. And so we don't bind ourselves by rigid institutional differences.
And Donald, the examples that Christine and Vincent have given so far of creating separate spaces but somehow connected back to the tradition, that seems to be the theme running through their experiences for me. You have the experience of having studied the transformation that happened at Most Holy Redeemer Church in San Francisco in the Castro. Tell us about that. Tell us about what it's been like for the people you spoke to do the transformation much closer to home.
Well, it wasn't an easy transition. It was with a lot of pain, conflict, and humor, and good leadership at the right time, and also the HIV disease also had a key role in bringing people together. But the Most Holy Redeemer in the Castro, that was a largely Catholic neighborhood through the 50s and even into the 60s. So when the gay community started moving in there, beginning in the 60s, the parish saw it as they were the invaders. People saw it, they were the invaders. In fact, so there's a lot of hostility from the Catholics in that parish to the idea that this was becoming a gay neighborhood. And there were many bars there, but gradually they were changing from being bars with heterosexual to bars with gay men. But the thing was, the parish started dying. The school closed, the convent closed, less and less people were coming. Then there was a moment where the Archbishop Quinn, sent Father Tony Maguire to be the pastor there. He was a very visionary person who saw what was happening, because the previous pastors hadn't really been able to cope with it. It was just beyond their theology, beyond their skills. He said, we need to be inclusive. We need to welcome the new community, but we mustn't lose the old community. That's why the title is The Gays and Grays, The Gays and the Grays. The Grays were mostly older women, mostly heterosexual, who had lost their husbands often. Their family might have moved to another part of America. So they formed a very close bond with the then younger gay male population that was moving into the Castro. And Father Tony was able to bring them together. And he didn't want it to be us and them. He wanted one community. So the AIDS support group had people from the straight community and the gay community. The choir had people from the gay and straight community. He wanted everything to be joined together. And that's what happened. There were very unlikely friendships. There's a Jesuit priest who's a friend of mine who grew up in that parish at the time, Kevin Ballard, and he tells the story of how his parents would go to church, and they began to befriend this new community. And he was growing up very surprised, and he said his father was they were very conservative, traditional Catholics, and suddenly his father was a friend of a leather dyke, and she was bringing her partner to dinner, and he said it's Sunday after Mass, and it was just a very unlikely friendship, but it happened because they were both shy and sat in the corner at the coffee hour. So they kind of talked to each other in a quiet way and became friends, where their partners were extrovert and were going around doing the social butterfly thing.
So you're describing a situation where a historical transformation, right, kind of led to perhaps some,
yes,
need to try, right, to revitalize a parish, and then the accident of HIV sort of,
yes,
clashing with that, and then people coming,
huge,
together around that, and then this coming out of it. If those particular threads hadn't been there, do you think this you could see transformations like this within parishes?
Well, it's a synergy of a lot of different things happening at the same time. Who knows if it would have happened if there hadn't been all those things together at the same time? I don't know. But the miracle is that they did happen, and it was a very powerful movement of the Spirit at that time. And it went beyond the Catholic Church. It touched all it was the one place where the gay community could encounter the straight community in the Castro was in the Catholic Church, because there was this healing, this reconciliation. But not just that, they were facing the issue of HIV together, and doing something about it. So the faith went out into action. It wasn't just about themselves. It was about caring for the people in their community. And even people who weren't Catholic, or they had been Catholic and they suddenly were alienated from their church and never went to church, when they died of AIDS at that time, they would go to that church because they knew they'd be welcome and they knew they wouldn't be judged.
415-841-4134 or feedback@cityvisionsradio.com. This is City Visions on 91.7 KALW San Francisco, your local public radio station, and on the web at KALW.org. I'm Joseph Pache, and tonight we're discussing being gay and Catholic in the Bay Area with our guest Donald Godfrey of the University of San Francisco, Vincent Pizzuto, also of the University of San Francisco, and Christine Fahrenbach, ordained deacon and member of the Roman Catholic Women's Priest Movement. 415-841-4134 or feedback@cityvisionsradio.com. So let's go to Adi from Berkeley. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Do you have a question or comment for our guests?
Yes. Actually, it was brought up earlier by the panel that it was believed that the change that's going to come from the church or from the magisterium is going to come from sort of the theological branch of the church. And I was just wondering, what do us lay people, or the lay people branch of the church, can do to sort of bring about change? I mean, obviously, we're not going to do like an Occupy the Church movement. I was wondering, what would be the opinion of the panel?
Okay, thanks so much for your call. Vincent.
Thank you.
Yeah, Adi, thank you very much for your call. I do think that, you know, to nuance the comments we made earlier, as Western democratic societies continue to move ahead in this direction, bringing about more equal rights for gay couples, gay marriage, et cetera, I think that that will, in fact, come to bring a significant amount of pressure on the level to which the church's current position becomes more and more untenable. So what I would say is continue to be a good citizen, to vote your conscience on this issue. And as we as democratic societies continue to move forward, that will inevitably have, I think, somewhat of a broader impact on the church.
So, Adi, thank you for your question. I think that the experience of GLBTQ Catholics has to be part of the conversation. It has to be listened to. It's not just a teaching church. We also have to be a listening church. It reminds me of a story of a priest friend of mine. He was in a parish where there was a lesbian parishioner who had never felt that she'd been recognized in the parish. And she went to my friend and said, you know, you're a great preacher. I love you as a priest. But, you know, I've never had my experience as a lesbian validated once in 20 years here. And he, being a good pastor, he listened to her and he gave a whole homily that was very inclusive and positive about the topic after that. And he said the most conservative family came to him that week and he said, oh, no, I'm going to get hit hard. And they came in and they said, you've come, and he said to them, you've come about the sermon I gave that was so inclusive and welcoming. And they said, no. We haven't. We weren't at Mass last Sunday. We were away. But we want to talk about our daughter who is lesbian. So, I mean, the things like that happen. But you have to speak out. So I encourage you to keep on speaking.
Yes, Christine.
Yeah, one brief comment. I think there has been a fair amount of self-advocacy by gay and lesbian people, gay and lesbian people. Excuse me, please, everybody in that group, advocating for themselves. And I think it is really important for heterosexual people, allies, as well as people who don't necessarily ally so much with gay and lesbian people, to also bring this issue to fore, that it is people, not the magisterium necessarily, but people who are aided by theological teaching and, you know, advanced theology to raise these issues and also do advocating as well. That's just so entirely essential.
415-841-4134 or feedback@cityvisionsradio.com. Again, 415-841-4134 if you'd like to join our conversation tonight. Let's take a couple of emails here. We have one from Jacqueline, and she says, it sounds like the church is just filled with what I would call, as a Latina, machistic ideology, because only weak men would fear women and what they would call effeminate men because they are not quote-unquote fully men. Which is kind of sad because I'm a bisexual woman who used to be Catholic, but with a lot of red tape all around the Vatican, which now trickles down and is forced upon the church community, has hindered and crippled my faith in people and somewhat in God. Thoughts there?
Yeah, I think Jacqueline points to a very important issue. So much of homophobia really is rooted in misogyny or the fear of hatred or hatred of women. For a man to be seen to take the role of a woman, either sexually or what would be perceived the role of a woman sexually or in any other way, or for, by contrast, a woman to be so bold as to be a strong or powerful woman, I think that many men fear these kinds of things. And so I think Jacqueline is right. And there is what she calls red tape. There is certainly a real pervasive sense of this throughout the church that does continue to affect even people on the local level.
This speaks to what you were saying earlier, Christine, about your first level dissonance with the church was its treatment of women. And then the second piece was its treatment of lesbians.
Well, right, and I agree with Vincent that misogyny is not. I don't think that's overstating the issue at all. And if you're a woman in the church, I think it's easy to get to a place where Jacqueline is to just kind of be an ex-Catholic, because you are, as Donnell was talking about just a few moments ago, about that person who didn't feel validated. That to be a woman, you're validated if you play a certain role, but you're not validated in so many other ways. And I think if you think about language as well, the language of the Roman Catholic Church is very, very masculine, and we don't have an inclusive image of God. God is He. And I think language is very powerful.
Just a couple of things. Please. I think misogyny and homophobia are strongly linked. I think a lot depends, to this email, a lot depends on your local experience of the church, whether it is welcoming and inclusive. But I would just say, don't let if your experience has been a hostile one or a negative one, don't let that get in the way of your relationship with God. Because my experience has been that God, that I have come to know and love, is not homophobic and is not a misogynist, but is a very inclusive and embracing God. And that's the God that I've come to know through my, paradoxically, is I've come to know that God in Jesus through my church, through the God that I've come to know in the Roman Catholic Church, is a God who goes beyond our categories and transcends them and breaks through. So don't let the sins, if you like, or the sinful structure of our church get in your way of your relationship with God.
I want to follow up, Donald. I agree with that 100%. If we look at biblical narratives, the story of Moses, where does he encounter God? In exile, with the burning bush. If we look at the story of Hagar, after she's cast into exile in the desert, she encounters God. And we could go on and give more and more stories. The woman at the well that Jesus encounters in John's gospel, it's the woman who's the outcast of that society that encounters Christ. So the place of exile, as we come to think of it, is the place of encountering the divine. That's where we encounter the divine, sometimes even more fully. We look at the road to Emmaus, where the disciples are outside of Jerusalem, walking away from the town, and there they encounter the risen Christ. So the Gospels, the Scriptures are full of stories of people who first and foremost and primarily and most powerfully encounter the divine precisely because of their place in exile from the institution or the community at large.
Mm-hmm. And all three of you are talking about how there could be other ways of reconnecting with Catholicism through the ways that you practice. When it comes down to the practicality of this all, though, is there what's it like to be practicing in the ways you are? And for parishioners at Most Holy Redeemer, is there a risk that the church is going to come crack down at some point? For example, what's the relationship between Most Holy Redeemer and the Archdiocese of San Francisco?
Well, there is a tension, and it's a struggle sometimes, but it's not one way. I mean, I think the diocese has learned a lot about this issue through the parish and parishioners also, and that comes and wanes. So sometimes it goes in one, it becomes a bit heavy, but it's not a totally, there is a conversation, a dialogue that happens because of the parish. Yes, there is always the danger that the parish it could be damaged and wounded, the special ministry there. But for now, it has been not exactly encouraged, but tolerated.
And from the larger view of from Rome, is the church too busy to be paying attention, or is it looking the other way in certain cases?
No, I think the church probably is. It depends. How do you speak about the church? It's, even the Vatican has many different congregations, and they're not all on the same page. They like to present a picture to the world that they're all on the same page, but they're not. So there are different voices within the Vatican who don't agree with each other, even on this topic. So there's a lot of nuance and a lot of... It's a very complex reality, the church. It's huge. And it's not one reality, but many. But at the moment, there is a sort of somewhat of an impasse in the sense that the teaching is, there's a certain, that's an attempt to stop the conversation and stop the theology and stop the experience. And I don't think in the long run that can work, but it can be a temporary experience for many people.
Yes, Vincent.
And in my own experience in being part of the Celtic Christian Church, I mean, when we talk about being an independent church, what we mean by that is that we're canonically independent, or independent are the laws that govern our church are independent. But we remain an extension of the Catholic Church. So because of those because of that canonical independence, we're in a little bit of a different situation where we offer sacrament of marriage to same-gender couples. We ordain women. We don't require our priests to be celibate, for example. So because we have sort of an enclave which protects us from, if you want to say, the canons of the Roman Church, we're able to function much more freely in our Catholicity and our Catholic identity with those things that we find much more essential.
And let's go to another email. This is from Paul in Oakland. I would ask the panelists to comment on the church's exploitation of the Stockholm Syndrome, a condition wherein hostages understand, excuse, and even welcome the maltreatment they suffer. For me, the Christian theology's rebranding of the murder of an innocent man into an act of redemptive love is a remarkably twisted semantic triumph, but not its last. If you can turn a father killing his own son into an act of love, you can turn Jews into rats, gays into pedophiles, black into white, you name it. The church hierarchy is simply reenacting the behavior of its God, turning its back on its own in an act of supreme redemption.
Yeah, I think that the presupposition behind Paul's questions is already erroneous. The violence that we look at in, for example, the crucifixion is something that the church had to contend with. It was not a ritual or sacrificial offering. It was a civil execution of the then leader of the disciples. And the theology that grew around that was one in which looks at that violence as a way of bringing violence to an end. I mean, what you have in Christianity is not a violent God of the universe demanding blood sacrifice. What you have is crucifixion. Love. What you have is a God who passionately dies for his people, not because he his father was requiring it, but because the world wanted it. It's the world's rejection of that. We see, for example, a lot of analogies made with Abraham and Isaac. You know, this notion of Abraham taking his son Isaac to the mountaintop to kill him and has only stopped at the last moment. But again, you have to look at that story in the context in which it was written, which was precisely to condemn the kinds of child sacrifices that were being made at the time in the surrounding nations around Israel. And so the point of this story in that context was precisely to preach against violence and against child sacrifice, something that if you don't understand that historical context, you very quickly lose sight of. So I think the caller's questions are initially misguided.
Christine.
I think that is a really brilliant response, and I can also understand, perhaps Paul is trying to play devil's advocate, but I can understand why he would have a question like that, because the church does as Vincent says so eloquently, that it really was not a blood sacrifice, but a reconciliation. But when you hear the basic Christian message, you know, up front like that, and you also see many things that the church does in the name of the God who sacrificed his son, I could see why people might have that impression. And that theology in the way that Vincent is talking is wonderful to listen to, but it doesn't exactly trickle down to all levels.
Donald?
No, just I very much like what Vincent, how he approached it, but I would say that the crucifixion is not that it's really a God who identifies with the human condition in all of our suffering and enters into every single circumstance and situation we can be in. That our God is there with us, especially the poor and marginal. Especially, so that's why this is a God who has a special attention and special care for LGBTQ people.
So as we are in the last 5 minutes of our program, I just wanted to get a sense of what are next steps for those of you like you, Christine, who are involved in the Women's Priests Movement, and for you, Vincent, in the Independent Catholic Church, as ways to move this conversation forward, to find a place for the conversation to happen from your vantage points. Because the whole point is, if you can't move the conversation forward unless the conversation starts happening. So how do you, from somewhat outside, bring the conversation inside?
I guess I would just want to look at, there's two chapters in the letter to Romans, chapters 14 and 15, in which Paul really is addressing factions within his community, those who he calls the strong and those who he calls the weak in faith. The strong in faith actually are those who we would consider today more progressive-minded, and the strong and the weak in faith are those he would regard it as sort of hung up on tradition. But one of the things that he points out between these two factions within the Roman house churches is that what's more important than who's right is that they receive one another in love. And we might disagree ideologically. You know, in San Francisco Bay Area, we're very good at diversity, but we're not very good at tolerating ideological diversity. And I think what Paul is calling for here is that we look to one another face to face, human to human, that we begin the dialogue and that we receive one another in love. This is the first commandment of the gospel, is to love. And if we're not loving, then we're making a mockery of the gospel, regardless of which side of this issue we stand on. So how do we begin to move beyond leaving each other in separate corners and move toward a place where we can actually begin to dialogue? And I think the Independent Catholic Movement is a place where that's beginning to happen, where people with different opinions and approaches to theology, sometimes it's very messy, but are beginning to dialogue, and in some ways are beginning to force other churches to look seriously at some of the positions we're taking.
Christine?
I have a different point of view. Just you know, I'm thinking of people that I work with in my practice as a psychologist, people who are gay and lesbian, and want their parents to understand them. And they say, I sent them that book and they haven't read it. They never bring it up. And, you know, my thought for them is to, well, take your life to your parents, or bring your parents to your life, in terms of, if you understand a truth, it's really important to both talk about it and also live it in a way that doesn't go just for conflict, but for welcoming, and to welcome that conversation, but by actually bringing people to where you are and going where they are. And I agree with Vincent. Yeah, there's not a lot of tolerance for ideological diversity, and that has to be, people who are progressive have to learn how to feel safe with that. Hmm. And to go from a responsive place rather than a reactive place.
Mm-hmm. And Donald, final words on this topic.
How do we find a space to disagree respectfully and in love, as Vincent said? And the other thing is, I think we have some of the spaces within the Roman Catholic Church to have this conversation. I think the Catholic University that I'm at with Vincent, the University of San Francisco, we have these kind of conversations. And I think that's a service for the entire church. And I think that that's part of the future.
Well, that's where we're going to have to leave it for tonight. Thanks for all of you for joining me this evening on City Visions. Our guests tonight were Donald Godfrey, Associate Director of University Ministry at the University of San Francisco, Jesuit priest and author of Gays and Grays, The Story of the Gay Community at the Most Holy Redeemer Catholic Church, Vincent Pasuto, Associate Professor in the Department of Theology and Religious Studies at the University of San Francisco, and Christine Fahrenbach, ordained deacon and member of the Roman Catholic Women Priests Movement. Thanks again.
My pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you.
For a link to this and other City Vision shows, to let us know what you thought about tonight's program, to subscribe to alerts and download podcasts, check out our website at cityvisionsradio.com. Our engineer this evening was Eric Jansen. Tonight's show was produced by Susie Britton. City Vision's senior producer is Judith Sansone, and Neil Fries manages our website. Join me next Monday as we celebrate City Vision's 20th anniversary in conversation with the show's creator and original host, Rose Levinson. It should be a lot of fun. Please tune in. This is Joseph Pache. Thanks for listening. Good night, and have a great week.